Georgia, Georgia, the whole day through, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind. Said a Georgia, Georgia, a song of you comes as sweet and clear as moonlight through the pines. Other arms reach out to me, other eyes smile tenderly, still in the peaceful dreams I see, the road leads back to you. I said, Georgia, no peace I find, just an old sweet song keeps Georgia on my mind.
Well, that's a little Georgia on My Mind from Ray Charles, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday with your show host, Andrew Harrod. And we're going to be looking at Georgia in the eye of America's political storm. We've had, of course, a very consequential week for American politics this week on January 5th and January 6th, both in Georgia and beyond at the Capitol Hill, involving Senate runoff races for two Senate seats holding the balance of power in the American Senate, and also the contested presidential election, Donald Trump contesting the November results in Georgia and elsewhere in the November election. And that's all now, all of these issues have taken a rather violent turn of events with the storming of Capitol Hill during the Electoral College count. And so to discuss these and all sorts of issues, we're joined by a veteran conservative political consultant, Tom.
Andrew. I've got some dead air. I'm sorry. I don't know if you can hear me. Maybe I need to dial back in. Give me 1 second.
Hello, Andrew. Andrew.
Tommy?
Yes, Tommy? I got you.
Oh.
Do you hear me?
Yeah. Okay, well, I was just introducing you there, and somehow we lost. But anyway, yeah.
Yeah.
So,
heard the very end of the introduction, and then I got air. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Well, just first introduce yourself. Tell us about your background in Georgia and your experience in politics to our listeners here.
Well, I'll try to keep it as concise as I can. I don't know. Obviously, I wasn't able to hear everything you said, but I talked about briefly before coming on air. I started out working for Jack Kingston, who was a long tenured congressman in Georgia. I worked on his actual first campaign for Congress all the way back in 1992. We actually got elected as the first Republican from that district, which is the first district since Reconstruction. And since that time, shortly following working with him, worked for Mitch McConnell for a couple of years. After that, got into trade association and legislative affairs and lobbying work. Have done that in a pretty, as a general statement, for the last, what would that be, 15 years or more. Among those things, I was the executive director for the Center for Military Readiness. Have worked with a number of fairly well-known national security-oriented conservative and other obviously pro-liberty and center-right groups, and just glad to be with you today, Andrew.
Well, it's excellent having you here. Well, thinking of Georgia, you know, this is people might in modern politics remember this as the home state of Newt Gingrich, where he got a start as a representative in politics. How is the what is the nature of politics in Georgia today? How has it changed over recent decades? Is it we've heard some talk about it? It's, you know, maybe becoming less of a red state and more purple. Maybe people might think of other southern states like Virginia or North Carolina that have become more battleground, or even in the case of Virginia, really become steadily blue in this last decade. What's going on in politics in Georgia in recent decades?
I think the phenomenon here, Andrew, is not dissimilar at all from what has occurred in the places you mentioned, particularly Virginia, and I can kind of sum it up in one word, and that's Atlanta. You have seen, obviously, Atlanta has been, you know, a driver just of growth, not just in Georgia, but throughout the South for not just the last couple of decades, but probably the last 50 years. And, you know, it has brought the sort of demographic shift that, you know, or at least in this election cycle for Republicans, has unfortunately not neared to their benefit. Andrew. My goodness, did we lose each other again? Hello. 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 Hello, Andrew. Andrew. Hello, Andrew. Hi. Okay, I am not hearing you, and I am being told over text by someone dialed in that they hear me and not you. So I will attempt to dial in again, Andrew, is the only thing I know to do here. This is interesting. Okay. Hi, Andrew. Andrew. Okay, well, I am understanding from other sources that other folks that I think are dialed into this show that I'm being able to be heard. This is Tommy Sears on Andrew Harrod's Conservative Casual Friday, that I'm being able to be heard, but he is not. So I'm trying to contact Andrew to see what we can do. I've dialed in a couple of times. Okay, sounds like you folks are hearing me. So we'll wait on Andrew to see if he can.
Can you hear me?
Can, yes, Andrew. Hello, sir. I was being told that folks could hear me, but not you. So wasn't quite sure. I'd lost you for probably a minute or more. Maybe we, Andrew, have we lost you again? I'm actually trying to see if I can get.
Yes, Andrew. Hello, sir. I was being told that folks could hear me, but not you. So, wasn't quite sure I'd lost you for.
Okay, so it sounds like for whatever reason we don't have Andrew. Folks, at this stage, I was in the midst of talking about my background and how I've worked in politics in Georgia and literally across the country for quite some time. I just heard something on the line. Is that Andrew?
Can you hear me?
Hello? Yeah, I've got
you.
You
hear
Andrew.
Me?
I don't know if I hear Andrew. I hear you.
Okay, excellent. I hear you.
Okay.
I don't know what's going on.
Go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, we were just talking about Georgia. So what kind of people have moved into Georgia? Is it just, you know, like a lot of Northerners, or have you had a lot of immigration? And
Well, I think all of that is true for Atlanta as well as it is for other large urban areas around the South and, of course, for around the country for that matter. I think what has and obviously you've seen the change. What has happened is the change has, as it has done, for example, in Fairfax County and Loudoun County and Prince William around the Washington, D.C., Virginia suburbs. You've seen this occur in places like Cobb County and Gwinnett County. Around Atlanta, where places that were reliably Republican, if not, you know, what we would necessarily consider, you know, rock solid conservative, but were at least Republican for the last decade and a half. But all of these last two elections obviously have shown the decided shift in that regard. Well, even going back to Brian Kemp's election showed that shift, because that was an incredibly close election where, going back to 2002 when Sonny Perdue was first elected governor here, that was a surprise win, obviously. I forget the margin. It was 4 or 5 points, if I remember correctly. It was a total surprise. Even if it wasn't that large, it was still a total surprise. And since then, the margins for Republicans have always been comfortable. But that has dwindled precipitously in the last couple of cycles or couple of elections. And I would attribute that to, again, as I just described, the demographic shift we've been discussing, but also heavily to the phenomenon of Stacey Abrams and the effort of groups like hers and George Soros-backed groups to ramp up and add to and manipulate the Georgia election system.
Well, looking at these recent runoffs on January 5th, we had these two Democrats win their Senate seats, leading to a 50-50 Senate with Kamala Harris will be breaking the tie then as vice president. How did, in particular, Raphael Warnock win in his race against Julie Loeffler? I mean, you know, this apparently is a real left-wing guy.
Oh, I think there's absolutely no question about it. If you go back and you look at the November results, obviously, Perdue won by, I think it was, well, I did not say not won, but he led Ossoff by 85,000 votes. And obviously the other with Warnock was what people generally refer to as a jungle primary, where you had him and and Collins and Leffler all in the mix together, and it was two vote getters were Leffler and Warnock, and they ended up in the runoff together. But just, you know, for argument's sake, say that you were going to assume that the 85,000 on the plus side that Purdue had in the general election to Ossoff more or less applied to Leffler and Warnock coming out of the general election, had it just been the two of them and a third candidate going to the runoff, you know, well then what you needed was that same level of turnout to come back out for Republicans in order to win. What happened was that didn't happen, which as a general rule for runoff races, that's to be expected. The bad news for Republicans was the Democrats came out at basically the same level they came out in the general election. And because Republicans did not turn out, the incredibly leftist, as you've indicated, candidates, particularly Warnock, were able to pull off a victory here. Andrew, my friend, I think we've lost you again. I'm going to continue until we determine what's going on with Andrew's connection. Not sure what's going on for anyone and for everyone that's out there listening. And clearly, these are important developments, not just for the state of Georgia, but for the country. I'm going to try to contact Andrew here and try to discern what our problem is. Andrew.
Hello?
Andrew.
Oh, hi. Can you hear me?
You again, my friend. I hear you, sir.
Oh, my goodness.
I understand that from text messages I'm getting that people are continuously hearing me, but we're losing you. And I don't understand why that's happening. But anyway.
Yeah, somehow I got thrown off the call again. But, yeah, you were talking about Raphael Warnock, and we were wondering how a person like that could win in Georgia.
Yeah, well, I actually continued on that along that line for a good bit there. But to kind of re-summarize it, basically, I think the gist was we just didn't see the level of turnout that you needed to have out of Republicans in order to prevent that from happening. And that was a function that's generally to be expected in a special election, which a runoff, you know, is in the general category of, that you're not going to get the same levels of turnout. As I said before we lost you, unfortunately for Republicans this time, the Democrats were able to keep their level of turnout basically on par with what they did in the general election in November, but the Republicans did not show up. And because of that, we got two extremely leftist candidates now taking seats in the United States Senate for the state of Georgia.
Well, in these Republican candidates, now you had David Perdue in his race against John Ossoff, and then Kelly Loeffler in her race against Raphael Warnock. Now, Loeffler was just appointed by the governor, Brian Kemp, recently to fill out the term of Isaacson, who had to give up his post due to health problems, if I recall correctly. You know, were these candidates did these candidates motivate people, or were they not very good, or what were these candidates like?
Well, yeah, as you point out there, one had been appointed, one was at the end of a six-year term. You know, I think under normal whatever you would like to call normal circumstances these days. I know that's a very, very relative statement that the times we're presently in, but under normal circumstances, I think Purdue was a perfectly fine, you know, generally conservative Republican senator. there was a great deal of controversy about Loeffler within and among Republicans, among some conservatives, because of both Kemp getting crossways with President Trump over appointing Loeffler and not Collins, but also the fact that for some people, Collins was sort of a product of, you know, the Atlanta Republican state house circles, which is where he had begun his career, whereas Loeffler was at, like Trump, an outsider, a business person. So there was there had never been, I think, a full resolution among those two factions about getting behind Loeffler, who ultimately was appointed, of course. And did that contribute to some lack of enthusiasm? I think so. But I think even more so, the problem in this runoff was Raffensperger and Kemp's absolute and total, just politically inexcusable failure to address the election anomalies that occurred in November.
Well, let's talk about those. What were the major anomalies? Of course, that came a big issue. You know, Trump had his phone call to Raffensperger, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger of Georgia, over the elections that was then leaked to the Washington Post, and you can listen to it online. What were the sort of the key anomalies in Georgia, could that have turned the election, or describe that?
Well, I think there's no question it would have turned the election. I think it's based on the evidence and information that has been uncovered since November 3rd that Donald Trump won the state. It was obviously, you've heard a lot about Dominion voting machines, and I think that is something that remains to be investigated. And I was disappointed somewhat to see that the Trump administration had dropped its pursuit of those suits, although I think they got some promise out of the state to share some sort of information. Hopefully Sidney Powell will continue to press that. But the major problem, I was actually a poll and recount and audit watcher in the state. And the major problem was the absentee ballot process, which I'm sure you have heard discussion of the consent decree that had been agreed to by Secretary of State Raffensperger and Brian Kemp with organizations, particularly the Fair Fight one that is headed by Stacey Abrams and to my understanding, is a Soros-funded entity, among probably others. Actually, there was another group, for that matter, that assisted with the Georgia election in the Secretary of State's office going all the way back to March before primaries, called all of a sudden the name has escaped me. It is Vote or something. But at any rate, it was a Soros-backed entity, and it actually worked as a contractor or a consultant with the Secretary of State's office to administrate this election. And that in and of itself is extremely problematic. And then when you look at the consent decree, which basically eviscerated the ability to check and validate absentee ballot, you in essence ended up with a process when you're under circumstances of COVID that the election is being conducted with huge mail-in vote that was clearly ripe for fraud. And of course, there are other aspects, but I'll stop there, let you continue with me from that point, and then I can obviously get into some other aspects that I also would like to cover.
Well, Brad Raffensperger in this leaked call with Donald Trump, he was saying that, you know, the hand counts of all the ballots had basically matched really within one or two ballots the machine count of the Dominion machine. So he rejected any idea of there being any problem with the machines. But of course, you know, you raised the issue. Others have raised, like Ann Coulter and others, that, well, of course, all these ballots were done under mail-in conditions, and there were key controversies. For example, like ultimately the requirement was waived that you didn't have to match the signature on the envelope of the mailed-in ballots with the signature on file of the voter. So I guess there are all sorts of questions about these mail-in ballots, which were such a considerable factor in this election, with people staying away from the polls under pandemic conditions. So would that have been the major cause of any sort of vote fraud?
Well, I mean, it's the fact that we're asking it clearly shows that it definitely provides opportunity for that, right? So I think as far as the consent decree went, the problem that got created there was it made it practically impossible and sort of, as we like to say nowadays, real time to validate the or to resolve disputes over absentee ballot signatures. So in other words, they created a process that was so onerous that it made it practically eliminated it, which I think was the objective of the Fair Fight Stacey Abrams people. But I'm glad you got to the hand count, because as I said, I was an in the room observer of that. And here is the overall, I know probably lots of listeners have heard, both in Georgia and Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, all of the horror stories about not being able to see, not being able to observe. And that itself was an issue in Georgia as well, for sure. But just from starting from the very initiation of the process of the hand count, it was being done by Board of Election staff. In other words, you were, quote unquote, auditing an election with the same people who conducted the election. We don't do that with an actual, honest, trusted audit in any other area of business or within government when you're wanting to get an actual valid result. It is basically situation of allowing someone to check their own homework or grade their own test. You basically had a process where the boards of election in each county used the same staff that ran the election to go back and hand count. That by itself is also a situation ripe for fraud and abuse. So again, there are multiple areas that open themselves up to question, and that was one in particular that when I first got in, I'd never been involved in actually auditing. This was supposedly an actual audit of an election at any time in my career, and standing there actually watching the people who had done the original count go back and quote unquote check their own work was frankly pretty appalling to me. What you should have had was in my opinion, was one representative from the Republican Party, one from the Democratic Party, looking at the ballot and determining what the intent was, and then if there were questions, then it went to the vote review panel. But that is not the way the hand audit was conducted. It was conducted with staff who were supposedly doing this. And the disputes did go to the vote review panel, but you were having the initial determination being made by people who had done the initial count. So obviously that disincentivizes admitting to any mistakes, right? So again, defeats the purpose of the actual objective of any, verifiable audit.
Well, then why are the state officials, like the particularly the Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger and the Georgia Governor Brian Kemp, why are they so sure in asserting that? I mean, they've been pretty firm in saying, you know, look, we had an accurate account. This process worked in Georgia.
Well, I mean, clearly they had committed themselves once they agreed to the consent decree with Stacey Abrams of standing behind this process, right? I mean, it was them who decided to, from my perspective, make a devil's bargain with an obviously, though I'm sure they make claims in their mission statement of her Fair Fight organization to be nonpartisan. Everybody knows, you know, who Stacey Abrams is. She obviously opposed Brian Kemp, which that in and of itself, you know, boggles my mind, but that they would go into a consent decree with her and her organization. But regardless, a partisan leading and a ostensibly nonpartisan organization that is going to somehow assist or work on voter registration and turnout in the coming election. But once they had made the agreement, then, you know, they put themselves in the position of having to defend it. And I think that's why you've seen what you've seen out of Kemp and Raffensperger in the months, and particularly in the weeks since November. I think are to some degree, in their slight defense, they are hamstrung by the law in Georgia, because the hand count law, my understanding, I mean, it is the law. The way in which it was conducted is actual statutory in Georgia, or the statute provides for the Secretary of State and the county boards of elections to conduct it in the fashion in which they did. And if that is the case, then all of that needs to be taken a hard look at, because it was not a valid audit in any sense of that phrase.
That's interesting. Well, you know, the controversies over the vote, I mean, how did – we're thinking of these runoff elections on January 5th. You know, what was the role of someone like Lynn Wood, this lawyer – from Georgia, who had been the lawyer in the past, who had led the defense of Richard Jewell when he was accused of being the 1996 Atlanta Olympics bomber. You know, he was involved in investigating these issues of voter fraud, and he came out and said, look, don't turn out and vote in another election if it's just going to be rigged. What effect did he have on this runoff election on January 5th?
Well, again, that's a you know, a question clearly open for debate among lots of folks. I think Wood was correct in his allegations of mismanagement and fraud on the part of, well, mismanagement on the part of Kemp and Raffensperger. You know, I'm going to reserve alleging on their specific part outright fraud unless and until this gets in a court of law. But as far as mismanagement, I think that he was correct. Lynn Wood was correct about those two. But I think where Wood clearly got off the rails was when he began telling people not to come out and vote, because whatever your questions were about the process, and clearly as I've outlined here, there were plenty to have questions about. There were plenty of questions out there to be concerned about. Put the day of the election on Facebook or somewhere on my social media, you can't win if you don't play. And you are conceding by default if you don't go out and vote. And would I can't speak, you know, to authoritatively to his motivations, but I think clearly he had some personal motivations of one kind or other to put that message out. Beyond that, political ambitions, business ambitions, I don't really know, and I can't really speculate.
Well, dealing with Donald Trump in general, Did he help or hurt this runoff election? People have talked about, some people have also speculated that his focus on election fraud helped the depressed turnout. Or also there's the whole issue of the stimulus checks, like he waited until signing the bill with the stimulus checks so that they didn't arrive until after the runoff or then later he was not able to get through in the disputes of the Republican Party getting a bigger stimulus check of $2,000. What was the role, what effect did Donald Trump have on these runoff elections?
Well, and there is where I think obviously there's been a lot of, another word that we hear a lot in recent days and weeks, misinformation. In my opinion, the one thing the Brian Kemp and Brad Raffensperger, but particularly Brian Kemp and other state office holders in Georgia that were Republican could have done to get the turnout where it could have been to win these races in the runoff was to aggressively investigate Donald Trump's charges of vote irregularity and vote fraud. And because that was, as I said at the top, just inexcusably ignored and dismissed by Kemp and Raffensperger, I think they killed their own turnout, or killed the turnout for the candidates, obviously, Republican candidates. I think that there were incredible, well, we know there were, unbelievably concerning questions in the minds of Georgia voters for going into this runoff. And by basically not or dismissing them or even castigating people who raised them between Raffensperger and Kemp, they again killed their own turnout. And it was the one thing I said a week or two after the general election, the one thing that the state party, Kemp, Raffensperger, other office holders in Georgia could have done to most energize the base is the one thing they refused to do and actually were undermining, and that was investigating the November election.
Well, going forward in elections, thinking about election fraud, what do you think Georgia should change in order to counter these problems? What reforms would you advocate?
Well, first of all, we got a governor's race in 22, and we've got to find a candidate that can win in the state. Quite honestly, I don't think Kemp will be that man, we will have to find that person, try to make whatever primary fight occurs as painless as possible, and get behind him full strength. As far as the changes that would need to happen, I've already gone through some in terms of Georgia election law. That entire recount audit process needs to be looked at very closely. And again, the entire election law regime in Georgia needs to be looked at with a fine tooth comb or taken apart very meticulously. And I think that also requires looking at or doing away with and revisiting the issues that went behind the consent decree that basically eliminated signature verification for absentee ballots in this state. And I mean, that's just ripe for fraud, because at the point that you've eliminated verification of absentee ballot, I mean, you and I could get an absentee ballot application for Mickey Mouse and fill it out, send it in, get the ballot back and put it in. And if you're not going to verify it, that vote's going to count. So, you know, you can vote 3 or 4 different times in that fashion. I just think that those are obviously the major glaring issues, and I'm certain there are others that would be discovered in terms of and maintaining voter ID. There is obviously going to be a push now that we've seen a change in leadership at the federal level, one of the first pieces of legislation, I believe, in the last Congress that are prominent pieces of legislation that was passed by the Democratic majority was election legislation that would have totally eviscerated voter ID, and you can count on that coming back. So we're in a position now, being at minority status at the federal level with a Democratic president, and obviously the questions that have arisen in Georgia and other battleground states, where we're going to largely have to fight a defensive action here, which means to hold the ground on the good things we have in these laws, like voter ID, and then fight to get the other aspects of it examined that need to be looked at, and of course, roll back things like were done in Pennsylvania unconstitutionally.
What about, on the other hand, if Donald Trump had been able to get through with a party leadership a $2,000 stimulus check for people, would that have tipped the balance in Georgia in the Senate runoff races?
Yeah, forgive me. You'd asked that in the earlier part of the question. Yeah, I certainly think that had some impact. I've said for weeks now that once this election was quote-unquote stolen from Donald Trump, that the Donald Trump voter who had come out for him in 2016 after not voting for decades or maybe voting at all in their life were not coming back. And these tend to be, or to a large degree are, you know, high school educated, blue collar, trade and other service and craft job people who, as I say, have not voted for decades or maybe in their entire life. And what happened in November basically confirmed the suspicions that had prevented them from voting for all of those years. So once they saw that happen, they were like, okay, what's the point? And then you add on top of that that, you know, the president that you did have confidence in is out here saying we need more money for these folks who are hurting, and then your own party leadership undercuts that. Well, sure, it certainly didn't help. I think that the concerns about the election in general were the overarching driving problem, and the way in which Kemp and Raffensperger refused to pursue those at the behest and the vehement urging of the president, but. Sure, the undermining President Trump, well, yeah, that's an issue of undermining their president in the eyes of these blue-collar folks and farming folks here in Georgia, undermining their president by from his own party, which is what they had unfortunately witnessed too much of during his presidency, certainly contributed to them not showing up.
Well, what do you think, looking, I guess, it's interesting you mentioned that you've worked before with Mitch McConnell. That raises a lot of interesting aspects. Now, we've had Kelly Loeffler originally supported this plan for the Electoral College certification on January 6th, that she would object later in the process before the final vote. She withdrew that objection. What motivated her to change on that? And perhaps as a follow-on, what do you think about Mitch McConnell's analysis of this strategy in the Electoral College to raise these objections?
Yeah, again, I think in terms of going forward, just in rebuilding from what has happened for Republicans in this cycle and these runoffs, it was a big strategic mistake. I think just in personal terms for Kelly Loeffler and her future, I think the reason that she withdrew the objection beyond, you know, all of the outcries on mainstream media was that she's preserving some sort of political future for herself. And she wanted to the extent she could at this stage, endear herself to Mitch McConnell. In terms of, you know, the larger strategy going forward, I think that's a major miscalculation by the majority leader and the rest of the National Party, because you basically dismissed the concerns of at least 75 million voters, likely many more, if and when these voter fraud claims are ever fully investigated and borne out. To me, that's political suicide. you basically are, as we Republicans or at least movement conservatives frequently say, insulting your own voters. And that's never a good strategy. Uh-oh, Andrew, have we lost each other again, sir? Well, folks, if you're still online and if you can still hear me, we, for whatever reason, have lost Andrew again. I guess we've still got a good bit of show here. I am just going to do what I can to fill air and not just totally leave us hanging in the airwave sense of the word, but not sure why we keep having Andrew drop.
Okay, well, Tommy, yeah, well, we've got, looks like we've got a caller here we want to bring in with a question and see what he has to say.
Sure.
Caller? Yes, you have a question for our show here.
Yes. You can call me John, by the way. Do you guys think that Biden becoming president is a serious thing, or is it just going to be another presidency just like always? The reason why I ask this is because I've never seen this level of government involvement in our everyday life. We're forced to wear masks. We're forced to curfews. And with Biden becoming president, I hear that he's going to put another lockdown in place. Our media is censoring us. Big tech is censoring us. Oh, my God. I've never would ever believe that Facebook, Twitter, and Google would censor us from information. So my question is, now that President Biden or the Biden is going to be president, do you think that they're going to escalate this? It's like, the government before was like a little puppy lion or tiger, you know, and it's a cute little puppy lion or tiger. And it, you know, you could play with it like a cat. But as soon as it tasted blood, then it becomes vicious and dangerous. And I think that's
so you're really worried about more. Yeah, you're really worried
ahead.
About more big tech censorship. Okay, what do you think about that, Tommy? What sort of things might change under a Biden administration with big tech?
Oh, I think, well, the door is clearly wide open, right, because we didn't get 230 repealed or even taken up by Congress, even though the president, tried to address it with the defense authorization bill. And again, you can have a fair argument about whether that was too little too late and sort of at the 11th hour to wait until you got what many consider to be a annual must-pass bill to fund the military to try to have that sort of fight. I mean, again, I agree with the president's objective there. I'm not certain that was entirely the best strategy. But leaving that aside, the door now that we have, Democratic control of the government, in all three, both chambers and in the presidency, the door is now wide open to basically whatever the Democrats feel like doing, because Chuck Schumer has said prior to this, during the campaign, prior to the general election, that getting rid of the filibuster is off the table. When you get rid of the filibuster, then the Senate basically becomes the House. Everything becomes enacted by simple majority rather than 60 votes. And when that occurs, then, you know, you've got the majority, which the Democrats do with Kamala Harris breaking every tie. They win every time as long as they keep their folks in line. And I think by and large, they'll be able to do that. There's talk of, you know, maybe Manchin and Tester being swing votes and maybe on some couple of highly contentious issues they may be. But in general, it's basically been my experience when Democrats get the majority and they have high priority agenda items, they pass them. I would point to particularly in 2010 when the gays in the military fight was going on. It had been stopped repeatedly all the way through that Congress. And in that year, the Republicans took the majority back from the Democrats, who nonetheless, in the lame duck session, mustered the votes to repeal the law on homosexuals being ineligible for military service, and jammed it through both the House and the Senate in a lame duck session of Congress, knowing that they were going to lose power the coming January. My point being here that now that they have a majority, though it may be only by the absolute barest majority you could have, which is breaking ties in the Senate with the president of the Senate, who is Kamala Harris, they will pursue their agenda. That I have no question about it, and that will include the Green New Deal. It will include packing the court, adding D.C. and Puerto Rico as states, legalizing however million illegals we have in this country right now. And yeah, I think you can pretty well forget about doing anything about Section 230. I will qualify that a little. I think there are people like Elizabeth Warren on their side, or correct me, Andrew, if I've got the wrong senator, but there's one or two that have raised some objection to the power of big tech. Yeah, I'm certain that she has been one because she's generally against big business overall. But the beyond that, the corporate and Chinese-backed Democratic Party will be very averse to doing anything with regard to Section 230, which governs social media platforms in this country.
Well, thinking of social media, of course, there's been a lot of controversy with what they've done. Well, of course, a big tech issue on censorship and so forth is, you know, involving Donald Trump himself after the whole uproar over these rioters going into Capitol Hill, the Capitol building. Thinking of Donald Trump, what do Georgians think of Donald Trump now in these closing days climactic, controversial closing days of his presidency? How do Georgians feel about Donald Trump?
I put it this way about the county I'm from here in Georgia, and I think as far as Trump voters goes, this is also a valid statement. And if there was a presidency of Republicans in the state of Georgia, Donald Trump would be president for life. That is how loyal and how strongly people feel about President Trump and their appreciation of what he's done for this country. Unfortunately, as we talked about again at the beginning of the show, you've seen the sorts of either through the election mismanagement and potential fraud and the demographic changes in the urban areas in the state, mainly Atlanta, that has basically, from their point of view, undermined and silenced and oppressed their vote. And so muzzled their vote, that's the word I'm looking for. And so for President Trump, in terms of the Republican Party in the state of Georgia, I think has not lost, at least in terms of the Trump voter has lost zero support, and actually probably they're stronger than ever now that on the margins of the Republican Party, where you've got the Never Trumpers and you know, establishment Chamber of Commerce Republicans and so forth, and what people like to refer to as GOP establishment, GOP little e, as I'm sure you've seen posted on social media at various times. Now, yeah, sure, I'm sure there's even outright opposition in some of those quarters. But in terms of the what we generally refer to as the base of the Republican Party. Donald Trump is as strong as ever before.
What is it in Georgia that really makes people makes Donald Trump so popular among Republicans? What in particular has he done?
Well, I think he's just he's done what he said he would do, just quite frankly. Not unlike, we hear about Washington Republicans, that has frequently been a problem here in Georgia. To give you an example, Brian Kemp ran on constitutional carry in the state. It has yet to come before the legislature. He's been governor now, will be over 2 years, I think, coming up this January. We're obviously in January, but in a few days, I guess. I don't think they've passed what would be the swearing-in date if this were a gubernatorial year. But anyway, whereas someone like Brian Kemp, who ran on the mantle of Donald Trump, or other statewide politicians who in the past have, made these promises, you elect me, and, we're going to see this conservative agenda item fulfilled or other, Donald Trump, as president and attempting to lead the Washington National Party, has fulfilled to the greatest degree that he has been able, despite opposition within his own party, and they recognize and appreciate that. Whereas now they see in people, I'm sorry to say, I worked for him 20, and I'm not sorry to say I worked for him 25 years ago. I like and respect Mitch McConnell then, and I appreciate and have great respect for a lot of what he's accomplished, particularly in getting President Trump's judges confirmed, which is absolutely crucial going forward to any prospect of reversing what we've seen happen in this election. But unfortunately, what he and other leaders in the Republican Party nationally have done is precisely the kind of thing that makes Georgia voters appreciate Donald Trump, because he has fulfilled what they have failed to for decades.
Well, that's interesting analysis. That's something we're going to have to consider going forward, as Donald Trump remains such a controversial figure that in Georgia and elsewhere in the country, there are indeed real loyalists. He does indeed continue to hold a great popularity. Well, Tommy Sears, I thank you for joining me, your show host, Andrew Herod, for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday. And I hope all the listeners will tune in next Friday for another episode where we like to look at events for conservatives and others. Thank you very much, Tommy, for joining the show.
Thank you for having me, Andrew. Very much enjoyed it. And everybody out there, it's not the best of times right now, but like I said, you can't win if you don't play. We can't overcome and emerge victorious if we don't fight.
All right, well, keep up the good fight. Till next time, thank you very much.
Thanks, Andrew.